Welcome to the All Souls Forum. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Tonight's conversation explores the motives and methods of law enforcement and questions its ultimate effectiveness in reducing crime and drug proliferation from a unique perspective. Former Deputy Sheriff, Immigration Agent, and Deputy U.S. Marshal John Adams spent his entire career locking up criminals. Over time, Mr. Adams began to believe that much of criminal behavior stems from endemic social problems like mental illness and poverty, issues not adequately addressed by our current criminal justice system, a system that arguably rewards a revolving door philosophy of locking people up, letting them go, and locking them up again. Adams also spent 2 months undercover as a federal inmate on the Atlanta-based television program 60 Days. These experiences fueled Adams' resolve to spend the next chapter of his life as a civil rights activist, helping people caught up in the system he knows so well, now from both sides. This show was recorded on Sunday, April 16th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Tonight's show's format is a little different than usual. In the first part of our show, forum member David Yeagle will interview Mr. Adams, and after the break, we will hear questions from the audience. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
Good morning. My name is David Yeagle. I'm a member of the All Souls and the Forum Committee. It is my esteemed pleasure to moderate today's edition of the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Forum, Kansas City's longest ongoing conversation, which has been a platform for the discussion of significant issues since 1943. I'd like to introduce our speaker today, John McAdams.
Thanks for having me, everybody. I appreciate it. And, you know, it's Easter Sunday, so it's still good to see everybody out. And due to the times, I always like to keep the conversations relevant with what's going on that day. So happy Easter. Let's talk about crime.
John here started in law enforcement at the age of 21 because he wanted to help people and serve his country. In 2001, he spent more than a year working as a deputy sheriff in the jail of operations. Deputy sheriff of jail operations in Kansas. He worked for the Department of Justice as a U.S. Marshal and a detention enforcement officer for the Immigration and Naturalization Service for 4 years. He also served in the U.S. Army and Kansas National Guard for 9 years as a medic and an officer. As a soldier and law enforcement agent, John became disenfranchised with the system and now wants to dedicate his professional life to civil rights activism. With his new MBA that he earned last year, John plans on starting a nonprofit organization in this conservative town. He wants to walk the walk and put his words into action, starting by living among a population he once put behind bars and now wants to serve.
That was a lot. So how I got started on this journey was I always wanted to serve the community and do the right thing, and I always looked up to law enforcement and superheroes and soldiers, and so I wanted to be that person. But once I got in and saw how the system worked, especially after 9/11, I saw the landscape significantly change, and I started to ask myself, what is the purpose of why we were doing what we were doing? And I think we have come so far away from that purpose, which is to make society safer for everyone. And I think that we are throwing lives away. I think that the way we are doing our business isn't really correcting the problem. It is just treating the correctional system and the criminal justice system as a big trash can. When you have all these other issues out here that you can't solve, such as addiction issues, mental health issues, poverty issues, what we do instead of fixing those problems is we just throw away the trash in the trash can. And unfortunately, those in power, I won't say all of them, but the system itself views a majority of our impoverished and minority and those that don't have access to things as trash. I just think that as a country as powerful as we are with the resources that we have no excuse to have 2.2 million to 2.3 million people locked up every day in this country. We also don't keep a lot of attention to the fact that out of those people that are locked up, we also have millions more that are still in the criminal justice system because of probation, parole, things like that. Also, just because they're off that probation, parole, out of prison, out of jails, they still have that scarlet letter on their chest, and it makes it hard to get a job. It makes it hard to get that health insurance that they need to take care of those significant issues that actually put them in bars to begin with. So I realized early on that I was not really helping the problem. I was just another cog in the wheel of a system that was broken.
All right. So, John, you recently went undercover as an inmate in the Fulton County Jail in Atlanta as part of the A&E television docuseries 60 Days in Atlanta. How did that experience affect your views on the criminal justice system?
Unfortunately, I cannot. Because of my contract right now, the show is still airing. I can't really discuss the show. But I will tell you this, that seeing the criminal justice system from both perspectives as a law enforcement officer and being undercover as an inmate, it was eye-opening. I had an idea what I was going into and what I was going to see, but I didn't know it was that bad. But the biggest thing that I got out of it was it really reinforced the thoughts that I already had going into it, and I have no doubts now.
All right, so let's go a little tough on crime. A lot of people say if you can't do the time, don't do the crime. What is wrong with holding people accountable for their actions?
First of all, I am still very pro-law enforcement. I have a lot of friends that are law enforcement, and I think there's a place for law enforcement. I just don't think there's too much law enforcement. This is a difficult question to answer. To look at the how we got here, which the war on drugs is a very questionable thing. Obviously, we should have enforcement of some kind, but what are we really trying to solve? People should be held accountable, but if we look at the mandatory minimum sentences, with a third-time drug possession charge is going to get you more time than somebody who's convicted of manslaughter. We see that every day. And the judges don't have any say or control about giving leniency or really having any discretion over the sentencing, because there's those guidelines in place. And if they go outside the guidelines, then, you know, they're unconstitutional at that point. So we really, this tough on crime attitude hasn't done anything to curb the crime in this country. Crime rates have gone up and down, but a lot of those statistics are based upon how we measure, what we're measuring, where we're measuring them, and also the changes in laws regarding what is a simple possession versus conspiracy to distribute, conspiracy to manufacture, all of those things muddy those waters when you just say, oh, drug crime is X amount of years, or, you know, this crime is X amount of years. So I don't want to go into a lot of statistics today because there's a ton, for starters, and that's why we have Google. I just want to encourage everybody to make sure when they look up crime statistics, they're going to a source that is trustable, not fake news, not, what do they call it, truthiness, alternative facts. Make sure that it's a source that is trusted. And also, when you look at this data and you look at the facts, really dig in and see what was it that they were actually measuring. What were the proponents and the components of getting that actual data? Because everybody here is smart, so we all know that we can take and pick and choose certain nuggets of data to prove a point if we don't look at it constructively and critically.
So you've gone on the record and spoken about the actual cost of the criminal justice system in the United States exceeds the reported data, since we're talking about data. Elaborate on what kind of costs are unseen and why is what we're getting not accurate?
Well, a lot of people, a lot of people throw out numbers about it costs an average of $25,000 a year to house an inmate. A lot of the data that's put out about the cost of incarceration is mainly due with prisons being a state prison or a federal prison. But what is not being taken into account too a lot of times is the people that are in county jails, private holding facilities. But the big thing, you know, there's also the cost of keeping the lights on in the courthouse. You know, law enforcement salaries, salaries for judges, salaries for public defenders and prosecutors. We don't take that into account. The budgets that come in to replace the chairs and the carpet when they need it. Another big thing that nobody really likes to talk about is the lack of tax revenue that is affected because those people aren't working. They're incarcerated. So, you know, there's that financial drain on society with nothing being put back into the
particular community. And so all of these factors have to be taken into account when you really get to a number. And the numbers will be incredibly astonishing once you add all that up. I think one of the other things we're going to talk about, too, is a lot of the free equipment that law enforcement agencies get from the military. And it sounds great, free 99, right? Local department gets that. But we paid for it at some point in time. Military didn't use it, or they did use it, but it's still functional and usable by the military, but they donate that. And it's high millions of dollars. We're talking, I think there's a thing I brought that I'd like to show. No, we'll talk about that. Okay. So there's a lot of factors, essentially, that we'll have to take into account before we come up with a number. So a lot of the numbers that you see are very simplified, and it sounds reasonable. But really, when you look at the total cost of everything, I don't know if we're really getting our bang for our buck. I saw a statistic on the way over here that was talking about for every dollar that we put into prevention of crime, society actually gains back $18.52 for every dollar.
All right. Keep going on that. We're talking about corrections and what is going on. You stated very publicly that correctional institutions do not correct anything. That name in and of itself is a misnomer. What is the current system providing, and how is that falling short?
Well, first of all, what programs each institution has is very independent of, you know, whether it's a federal institution. You know, each state has their own things. Even some counties have programs. There's nothing uniform, and there's not really a lot of accountability across the board to make sure that there's drug and alcohol treatment programs, access to mental health care, classes to help you be, you know, get back on your feet when you get out. In fact, most places, when you get out of jail or you get out of prison, there's not any resources to, they give you $20, or some states will give you $25, $50 and a bus ticket and your old clothes and say, see you later. And so, you know, if I was locked up for 20 years, and I was given $50 and a bus pass and the clothes that I came in wearing that's been locked up in my, you know, holding locker for all that time. If you think about all the changes that have occurred in just in the last, I mean, I can't keep up. My kids are amazing with social media and iPads and iPods and all that stuff. I can barely turn one on. So when these guys who have no experience with just modern-day technology, how do you find a job today? Do they know how to put a resume together or fill out an application? Or so a lot of those jobs that they knew about when they went in the last time don't even exist anymore. And no one's giving anyone, I don't say no one, I don't like to deal in absolutes, but the majority of your facilities, if they do give those resources on the way out and that counseling on the way out, it's minimum. Obviously, there's that stigma where they're a criminal, so why should we care?
I'll just follow that up. Why should we care?
Because I'm going to go back to the old adage. You're only as strong as your weakest link. And this is our community. And if we are not doing our part to fix those weak links, then are we making ourselves better and stronger as a society and a community? I think by that logic, you'd have to say no. Not only from a financial standpoint, but also from that secured standpoint, that false belief that society is safe because prison and jails exist. But you have to understand, most of these people do get out. They will be back on the street. And you have to put yourself in their shoes and think about it from their perspective. If, and this is the majority of the people that go to jail and are incarcerated, it's poverty. And if I grew up without a father, if I grew up without a family that taught me how to behave in a proper society, if I didn't have that, how would I know it? If my dad was incarcerated and my grandfather was incarcerated and sold drugs and was involved in a gang, why wouldn't I do that too? A lot of people do, and a lot of people would, because in these communities, the gangs and the drug dealing, and that's their family, that's their safety net, that's their security. And if you look at Maslow's hierarchy, safety and security is pretty important. I mean, it's one of the basic necessities that we have to have. So they rely on that as their family, as their support system. And a lot of people will say also, well, why don't they just go get a job? If you have no skills, most of the people that I met on the inside didn't even have a driver's license. access to care, access to employment, access to resources, access to all of these things. If you have to take a two-hour bus ride to get to a minimum hour job, a minimum wage job, why would you do that when I can just walk down the street corner and I sell, you know, a little bit of drugs and make four times that amount and take care of my family or take care of my needs? I don't know. If I grew up in that environment, we are our environment. And so we're just going to have this perpetual cycle. And unfortunately, that perpetual cycle is growing. And as people get poorer, as people struggle more, they're going to do what they have to do to survive. A lot of these people, and they are people, and I hate it when people say, no, they're not people, they're criminals. No, they're people. And so many of them have such good hearts. They have feelings too, and they have people that care about them. And until we start looking at them as people instead of as a statistic or instead of as a criminal, we will never get over this hurdle. It's easy for the ego of the if you've never had to experience the criminal justice system, you would have no idea what's going on. And fortunately, a lot of you won't. And unfortunately, some of you have. It's easy for those that have never had to experience that, to have a loved one be locked up or yourself locked up. It's easy to dismiss those people as something other than an animal or a statistic or a criminal. And that is easy to suffice our own personal egos because it dismisses our responsibility to these people. One of the things that, you know, I want people to do, and we'll talk about this more later, I'm sure, is to encourage everyone here to look inside and not be dismissive. The action you can take is to talk about it, research it, but mainly you just have to change your outlook. And I'm not saying you people specifically, of course, but people out there.
All right, so what changes do you see will actually make a difference and why?
Well, I think, you know, part of it, I've already kind of gotten into that. It's just our culture of mindset. And really, once we start to say, okay, there's all of these people that are in the situation they're in because of all kinds of different factors, whether it be the poverty or the mental illness or the just lack of access to resources. You know, as a community, we need to advocate for them. We need to give them those resources. Like I said, the return on society is $18.52 for every dollar we spend. And we have to stop as voters. We have to stop looking the other way when our government says, we're going to spend all this money on enforcement, on a drug war that has failed, on, you know, a lot of the excessive DOD funding and say, okay, let's put that money towards healthcare. Let's put that money back into the community. And that's going to have to come from everyone in this room and everyone that's listening. And until the lawmakers hear that and really listen to that, then we're going to be stuck in the same perpetual cycle. And it's going to get worse as the gap between the wealthy and the poor continue to increase. We're going to see quite a bit more of the survival instincts and revolt on society in general.
All right, so you already kind of touched on this, but how do you propose that we actually start working towards these changes? Right, so right now, some concrete things that we can do to change.
Well, there's a lot of, first of all, you got to educate yourself. And that's where it comes into finding, you know, resources that are going to give you that ever-changing data and be a critical thinker when you look over that data. The next part of the conversation is to have the conversation. You've got to start talking to people. Talk to your friends. Talk to your family. Put stuff on social media. You know, we have this great resource in Facebook and Twitter and Instagram where we can reach a lot of people that you may not get a chance to talk to or have a long conversation with, but something you put up may spark that interest. And, you know, if your friends and family know it's important to you and they trust you, they'll say, David, why are you so interested in this all of a sudden? Well, let me tell you. And the other thing you can do is really put pressure on your lawmakers to look at the issues and look at the problems. Email them, call them, send message to them. They're all available on Facebook and Twitter, and make your voices heard. And let them know, because a lot of times these individuals, they've got so many issues on their plate, they're not aware that it's even viewed as a problem. If the community's not loud about it, they don't have to deal with it, because the squeaky wheel gets the grease. But The criminal justice system is enveloped in all these other problems. Healthcare, you know, the Affordable Care Act and what's going on today is a huge topic of conversation. So it's getting a lot of attention, but what a lot of people don't know is that especially lawmakers that are refusing to pass Medicaid expansion in the states to include this state, they argue that they aren't seeing the benefit. But if you look at Texas and Pennsylvania, the five highest states that had Affordable Care Act or Obamacare enrollment, their crime statistics dropped by over 20%. One of them was even, I don't know if it's Pennsylvania or Texas, one of them was 28%. The crime rates dropped. And if you think about 28% of a huge prison population at $25,000 a year, that return on investment, the return on tax revenues, it's kind of a no-brainer. But you have to educate your lawmakers as well.
All right, you were talking about that slippery slope on extends to our poverty gap, our wage gap that's taking place, the fact that we are in two states here next to each other that have not expanded Medicaid. You've already kind of touched on that. Where do you see that if we don't do something, where do you see us in a few years along that slippery slope?
Well, I think I'm not an economist, and there's so much information out there to see how it's going to impact dollar-wise. So I can only rely on other people's calculations. But if you look at the gap, and I think I don't want to throw a number. Somebody will call me out on it. But we know that the gap is extended pretty exorbitant amount in just in the last 10 years, actually. Where do I see us in a few years, three years? I don't know where I see us in 3 years. I mean, I'm scared for the next 4 years, so, for many reasons. I don't know. I don't know where we're going to be. That's a hard question to answer.
All right, you've both been a proponent and an adversary regarding police armament. We touched on this a little bit ago. Can you kind of clarify where you're at with that? Because, again, you were in. And got to play with all those toys.
Let me tell you what an MRAD is. An MRAD is basically a tank that has tires instead of tracks. Why some of our little police departments around here have those is kind of baffling to me. We're not supposed to have military action on our own citizens, but if you look at the armaments with the M16s, the M4s, the Army donated to local police departments a huge number of bayonets. That is a killing. That is not going to stop, the threat. That is a up close and personal. You're at a last resort, stabbing someone, in a critical place. I mean, that's a soldier's weapon, and our law enforcement has the way we look at law enforcement over time with these toys and these weapons. You have to ask yourself, why are we spending our money on these kinds of things? What's the purpose of it? We do have some other positive things, though. Tasers are better than just shooting somebody. The expenditures on some of these other things are kind of over the top.
So how is a local police department justifying the fact that they have an MRAT? I mean, what are they saying that they need it for, and what could... From a law enforcement perspective,
right.
Why would they want this?
That's a good question, actually. I'm sorry. That was a good question. So things changed considerably after 9/11. The Patriot Act was a big portion of this, and the big scare of terrorism. So it allowed the federal government to fund these police departments either through military surplus or brand new equipment such as the MRAD. And in case of terrorist attacks or terrorist events. That's kind of a simplified answer, but that's what gave us that, and most of you were here on 9/11, so you know how we felt then. And we were open to new ways of protecting ourselves. But let's be reasonable. Let's be reasonable about it. So that kind of opened us up on that slippery slope that we were talking about to now we're passing out bayonets to police departments.
All right, you've been very public about the unfairness of the criminal justice system regarding minorities. Being a white guy, tell us about how your stances have either evolved or changed and where you're coming from on that now.
Well, like I've alluded to before, I think it's a poverty problem. not necessarily a minority problem, but unfortunately, minorities are a large portion of our impoverished in the country, and we see that in the jail population. The numbers of minorities are way high. The percentage of minorities in jails and have been through had touches with criminal justice and have been in the criminal justice system far outweigh the number of white people. So we can't ignore the fact that it is a race issue, but then you have to ask, why is it a race issue? Is it simple racism, or is it product of the poverty system? And Michelle Alexander is she's an author, but she was also a former director of the New York ACLU, and she's an attorney. She wrote a great book called The New Jim Crow. And in that book, it really talks about how over time, the criminal justice system has started to replace slavery. And it's a very interesting book and topic. I don't know that I can say from my personal experience that is the sole issue or the all-encompassing issue, but statistically you cannot deny that there is a huge racial disparity in prisons and jails and touches with law enforcement. And that does nothing but help perpetuate the image that these are not people, these are criminals. And it's a really sad place to be in, because as we evolve as a society, we start to realize that's not true, but yet these stereotypes still exist, and it really does hurt those communities. But it is a poverty problem. And until we address the poverty problem and take away that need for that survival and that security, then people will do what they have to survive.
To kind of touch on that as far as the evolution of our criminal justice system, you know, that paradigm is multifaceted that you alluded to. Describe that evolution and how we've gotten to where we're at now.
Well, you know, the biggest issue with that involvement started in with President Nixon when he announced the war on drugs. President Reagan took that to the next level. President Clinton even took it to a higher level because he knew that he couldn't win against the Republicans if he didn't get tough on crime too. So instead of standing for what, you know, I hope he would actually believe in, he went the opposite route to win. And that involved things like three strikes and you're outlaws. And so we're basing our criminal justice system on baseball adage, you know. There's no statistics or data to prove that three strikes makes you incurable or a complete waste on society at that point. It was a catchy thing. It caught the news, got them votes. So as the drug wars progressed, like I said earlier, you have to actually look at the specific laws. You know, we have, you know, manufacturing drugs, you know, distribution. We have simple possession. Well, each drug has its own little sentencing as well. You don't get as much time for pot as you do for meth or cocaine. But what's interesting, the laws that were passed during the really hardcore drug era is that crack cocaine carried a much harsher sentence than powder cocaine. Who was using powder cocaine? Rich people, mostly white people. And the impoverished communities, mostly minorities, were using crack cocaine. So they put harsher sentences on crack cocaine, it changed the way we perform searches. It changes the way we get warrants. It gave more probable cause for officers to search people, to search their cars. And really, as we all know, it doesn't take more drugs off the street because somebody else will come up and take over where that person left off because there's a demand for it. So unless we start treating the demand issue, we're not going to get rid of this problem. We can lock people up all day long, but those people will get out, and they'll have less resources when they get out, so they'll go back to doing what they know how to do. If you want to look at the statistics from drug-related crimes versus all the other crimes, depending on what state you're in, it's in the 60% is like drug crimes. We had less than, in the 60s and 70s, we had, I think it started off at 400,000 people incarcerated, 400,000, something like that. And now we're at 2.2 million, 2.3 million. And that's just in prison, that's not the jails.
All right, and USA Today had a recent article related to beefing up for-profit prisons, which is a complete reversal from the last year of the Obama administration under our current Trump administration. How is that going to factor in to what we've been talking about?
Okay, so the way this works is one of the catalysts for that is the bigger push on immigration and immigration issues. When you are going to threaten to deport more people, you got to find a place to house them, and that place is jails and prisons. After 2001, September 11th, we not only really got into the privatized jail industry, But we also, the feds also said, here's what we're going to do. They went out to some of these smaller communities, Jefferson County, Kansas, Bates County, Missouri, and they said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to build you a brand new state-of-the-art facility, and we're going to give you funding to facilitate it. It's going to bring in revenue to your little town. And all we ask in return is that you hold so many beds open for our federal prisoners, whether that be an immigration prisoner or somebody else on a federal crime. So you can see that there's incentives to, for those little communities as well, to lock people up. And there's incentive to put people in jail because jails are rewarded for that as well. Everybody who's ever had a speeding ticket before knows that that speeding ticket helps fund the department and the city and their resources. How is it not an incentive for them to write more tickets? Anybody that says they don't, anybody that says they don't have quotas or they don't do this, there's still encouragement to write those tickets because that's how their salaries are paid. That's how they get new carpet. That's how they get a new car. That's how they get, you know, new toys. That's how they get their promotions and they open positions for new officers. How is there not an incentive to make more revenue? Okay, you can raise taxes, of course, but if you raise taxes too much, you're not going to get reelected. So we would rather have more revenue coming in any stream we can. Take that idea and then blow it up to a bigger level. Blow it up to the drug war, blow it up to the immigration issues, and you can see how profitable it can be to put people behind bars, lock them up, and while they're in there, spend as little money as possible to make sure that you give them the required needs of what is mandated per the feds or per the state. And you'll see that very drastically as well. And I will tell you, in our communities, for the average person, when the economy gets tight, the first thing that gets cut is mental health services, addiction services. Do you really think that it's the incentives of these jails, private or public, to give people these resources that they desperately need? These are the people that need it the most. So make as much money as you can, spend as little as you can, and that's where you get your profits. That is simple economic.
To your point that it doesn't correct anything, the idea that we're trying to reduce recidivism in any way really is not encouraged in the current system. Because having them come back time and time again is how they're making their money. And why would I want to get the attic clean? Why would I want my psych patient that we keep locking up, why would I want them to actually stay on their meds?
That's a great question. As you're incentivized for putting those people and making money off of those people, you have to really ask, okay, that recidivism rate that we have that's very high with these issues, we're putting them back on the street. We expect them to, we almost expect them to come back to jail. So what was the point in locking them up in the first place? We're just going to keep putting them back out there without any resources or tools to fix the problem that got them there. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make our society safer. And that's why, you know, I'm begging voters in the community to start saying, look at things from a different angle and say, you know what, this really doesn't make me safer. This really isn't fixing any problems. The whole correctional doesn't correct anything. I mean, it's almost a joke. Tell me what they correct. If any product or company was selling you something and you had the very poor success rate or accomplishment rate of whatever product you were buying, you wouldn't buy from that company. So why are you buying this nonsense that is put out there that you're safe now? You're okay.
While we're talking about money, let's talk about the Koch brothers. Even conservative Koch brothers have recently come out as advocates for criminal justice reform. So isn't that a step in the right direction?
We'll take anything we can get. And I can't speak specifically to the Koch brothers on this. And I don't want to because I don't want to have to put a mirror under my car. I'm just kidding. I don't want to say anything. But when it looks like a duck and quite, you know, a duck, you know. But you have to look at some of these people and organizations that have had strong stances against other areas of interest. You have to ask, what is in it for them? And I'm not going to say the Koch brothers on this, but there are companies out there that are pushing and donating a lot of money for criminal justice reform. The reason is because they can sell ankle bracelet monitoring systems or implant other ways of monitoring, With the new GPS technology, you still have to have somebody to monitor it too. So these companies contract with local government so they can monitor these people once they're out of jail. Or once they're, instead of going to jail, they can do these systems. And guess who pays for that? The taxpayers, but also the person that's getting the sentence. We already talked about how poor they are. We already talked about the only way they made money and put food on the table before was by selling drugs. But now they can't because they're on probation and being monitored through GPS. How are they supposed to get the money to do it? Good question. So they get locked up again. And now the private company, the private industry has made the money on the systems, and they're making money locking people up again. And it's not the inmates making the food, it's a private company. It's not the inmates doing the laundry, it's a private company. Making the clothes, making the inmate garb is a private company. Doing the construction, the painting, all the maintenance, it's a private company. There's so many private contractors that have their hands in this this world of incarceration, the criminal justice system, that once you start peeling back the onion, it really starts to stink.
In the early part of your remarks, you got a little bit into drug issues. And in the later part of your remarks, you went back to that again. So my question to you is, how do you balance out the need for drug education before incarceration as well as treatments during incarceration with the issue of the difficulty of dealing with people who have been addicted for such a long time? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and I'm not a mental health professional or an addiction specialist, so I have to caveat that. But I think every addiction specialist or counselor pretty is uniformly in agreement that once you have those addictions, it is a lifelong process. And so even if we do give education before incarceration or during incarceration, we still need the resources to continue to work on that issue and that problem personally. And even if that's why I'm saying it's not good enough, even if we just give counseling in prisons, because once they're released, they need that continuity to follow through on it. And there's a lot of great organizations out there that are free, but a lot of individuals, they will self-medicate due to their mental health issues, and if they don't have access to their prescriptions that they need for bipolar disorders or whatever the issue is, they're going to go find other ways to do that, to take care of their problem. And so it's our responsibility as a society to give them that continuity that they need. Yes, sir.
Thank you so much for coming. You gave very valuable insights. Based on your own personal experience with these inmates, do you think that it would help? It would seem obvious that it would, but just based on your own experience, if there were greater intervention with young people, particularly young males, in high school, and if we perhaps offered a pathway for higher education by paying for trade school or at least 2 years of community college, that this would make a difference?
I think it's important that, you know, access to education isn't, but we have to start earlier than even high school, and we have to start in grade school. If you look at the high numbers of people that have parents with the same issues, they're learning that behavior at a very, very young age, and they grow up with it. So if you took someone that had no desire to, never thought it was going to happen, no desire to go to college, I'm not saying there aren't outliers with this, but generally most of them don't even finish middle school. I mean, I don't say most of them, but a lot of them don't even finish middle school. So that value on education has to start way earlier. And we are already paying for public schools, and we need to make sure that you get behind your public schools to make sure that they are doing the right things for the kids and teaching them all throughout the educational lifespan. So that they, if we did have the opportunity to help them out with college and things like that, then they would be ready for it versus those that have never been given a chance to. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, sir. Good question.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
First, to quote Bill Clinton, it's the economy, stupid. But I'm going to go back to one of the later questions that David asked about powerful people saying prison reform is needed, getting behind prison reform. What do you think is meant by that phrase, prison reform?
Well, it depends on who you ask. That's a good question. I mean, I can't answer for any politicians or anyone else for that matter on that subject and issue. But I think we all can agree that when we say we need to reform prisons, I think it's pretty obvious that we do. And it helps soften some of their stances, you know, with the public, regardless of what their internal motivations or feelings on it may be. I think the bigger question is not just do we need reform. I think the bigger question is how do we do the reform? If we continue to slap a Band-Aid on a hemorrhage, we're just going to keep bleeding. We may cover it up and it won't look as bad, but we'll still bleed out fast on the inside, and that's what's happening. So I don't want to see Band-Aid fixes. This is such a hard problem to solve, because there are so many components that add to it. There's the economic aspect that I spoke about. There's the healthcare aspect that I talked about earlier. So until we fix those, we have to fix those, or we can't fix this. Like to the other gentleman, to his question, okay, so we're going to reform things, and let's say we're going to spend money on mental health care within the prison and give them the counseling that they need in the prison and give them the medications that they need in the prison. But what about when they get out? That's why we have such a high recidivism rate in the system. So we have to look at things differently. Like, it goes back to what I said earlier. You're only as strong as your weakest link. And so if we're leaving these people out to dry, of course they're going to come back. Of course we're going to continue to see this problem over and over. And of course it's going to be a monetary drain on society, which the number is way higher than people know.
So my question kind of follows up directly to that. It seems to me that one of the roots of the problem is that it's about punishment. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if you are aware of, you know, in other countries, other societies, mm-hmm. if they have a different view on, you know, what do you do with a murderer, you know?
Yep.
Because we're still going to have murderers even if we fix some of the systemic issues, so.
There's a movie Michael Moore made, I think it's what is called, Who Do We Invade Next? And he was taking great ideas from other countries, and his shtick was that he was going to steal those ideas and bring them back to the United States. And one of them was how they treat prisoners. And I can't remember what it was one of the Swedish or Nordic countries that, I mean, some of their jail areas looked better than a lot of people's homes in, you know, our country. And they were very soft on crime. But they had better turnouts as far as crime statistics and issues within their society and community, and they put more emphasis on rehabilitation. America doesn't like to think that way, to go back to what you were saying, and I agree with you 100%. We're a punitive country. You see it in all sorts of media things, with the television shows that we watch, to how we actually we treat kids in our nation, we punish versus reward, and it's always a punish or a reward, but there's no teaching moments. There's no way to understand why that behavior existed in the first place and dealing with it from a compassionate point of view to actually evoke that change. If you are a good person and only doing good things because you are afraid of that punishment, does that really make you a good person, or does it make you a slave to that thought process in that society? And only you can answer that for yourselves.
Yeah, thanks, John, for coming.
Yeah, thank you.
I'd just be interested in a comment from you about this thought, and that is that there's been the idea tossed around that politicians start wars to keep a lot of people employed, especially young men in the military, and you know, same with prisons, keep people in prison. I mean, can you imagine the unemployment rate if you know, our military-industrial complex was reduced and our prison population was reduced? If all we have a flood of young men back into the society, and unemployment would skyrocket, and that would be a huge problem for politicians.
Yeah, well, I mean, even the way that I agree with you, and that's a very good point. And like I said, I'm not an economist. What I can say about that is, if you go back and even look, if you include inflation over the last, you know, 50, 60 years, you see that average median household income has remain fairly stable. But you also have to look at the changes of the dynamics of that household system, with
two-income earners is required to maintain that same level of comfort. So that has to be included too in that thought process, where in a lot of cases in society, or in our country back then, you could live on one, you know, the man was the breadwinner and the woman stayed at home, and, you know, or the woman worked and the man did whatever, but you could survive on one income, and you can't do that anymore. I mean, some people can, but that's where that widening of the poverty gap is showing. Yeah, it might put people out of work. I can't speak for that, but at the same time, that's why we have to fix that poverty gap and that wage gap. That's the bigger issue. If you fix that, then a lot of people would drop out of the workforce. That's my opinion, though, as a non-economist.
Good morning, John.
Sir?
I want to first of all say that...
I like your shirt, by the way.
Good. Hold that thought. Because I'm going to ask you a really personal question. If I imagine, John, 10 years from now, one scenario is you're the go-to guy on CNN in one of those panels, of which anybody who tunes into CNN these days seems to see are endless. And there's a little bit of evidence here today that the brand of John is getting worked on, and I'm not opposed to that idea. But those of us who are kind of looking to hand off the baton to younger people that have the energy and are investing and thinking the way you've been have some uneasiness about the path where people get sucked up into celebrity and get neutralized. So would you mind sharing a little of your thinking about that peril?
Well, to go back to the first part of your question, I'll say this: your question started off as my most hated interview question. Where do you see yourself in 5 years? And I hate that question, because if you'd have asked me 8 months ago if I would have been on a television show or be standing here talking to you guys, I'd have said you're crazy. If you'd have told me in high school that I would have been a cop, I would have said you're crazy. So you never know what opportunities are going to come your way, and you never know what opportunities will go away. And so you have to make the best decision you can at the time and still stay true to your cause. And I think that everyone that knows me and has been a part of this project and a part of who I've spoken with would know that I'm very passionate about this issue and all the issues that we talked about. I don't watch a lot of sports. This is what I do. Hopefully that answers your question, but I can't say in 10 years. Hopefully, getting ready to go on vacation in the Bahamas or something. I don't know.
Hi.
Hi.
I was curious, are you a Kansas City native?
I've lived in Kansas City since I was 12 years old.
Okay.
So about 23 years.
Awesome. And then I think you said you have a nonprofit, or you're going to start a nonprofit, and I'm curious about that and how we can get involved. And I think he said he was going to start a nonprofit, and I was curious. Sorry, I'm not used to microphones. I was curious about that, how we can get involved, and what the area of focus, because as you said, there's so many problems that go into this.
Yeah. So when that bio was created, it was before the elections, and I still am very interested in that. However, what I've seen is I've been a part of the women's marches and all. The election really evoked a huge response from the community, and people. What I'm seeing is I'm working with all these different groups for all these different interests. What I'm seeing is a lot of these interests are concerned about their specific interest, and I see them, you know, siphoning funds away and fighting over the crumbs they get for their specific interest. So, I think going forward, if I was going to, there's so many organizations that already exist that maybe I could help out. I have to weigh that. But also, I think that there has to be something that brings those organizations together, because I think that, you know, the women's issues do affect the healthcare issues, and it does affect the incarceration issues, and it doesn't, you know, all of these things it totally affects, because it's also interweaved. And that's why it's a difficult problem to fix. So if we don't get everyone on the same page and working together, then I think we're going to continue to fight each other. And the individuals that don't want to see any progress will they'll continue to win, and I think it's very important that we
we do start changing the way we look at those as well. So I see myself going more in that direction than making another, because there are some great organizations that already address these things and some local. I'd like to help them grow because they do already have an establishment.
Okay. So if we wanted to get involved in the cause, like how to find out what those organizations are and...
Yeah. I'm going to be... So as the program that I'm not going to talk about, because I can't, as it progresses, you'll start to see me become more involved with social media and things like that. I'm still locked down to certain requirements, but my Facebook and Instagram are up there. Is my Twitter, and my Twitter's up there as well. So if you want to write those down, follow me, and I'll be putting out information as we continue forward. And so I do have some exciting announcements coming up in relation to some works within the community, but we're just not ready to offer that information quite yet. But so it's coming.
Thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Right,
happy Easter and spring solstice.
And in lieu of a real honorarium, you have your Made in America Forum mug.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed tonight's presentation, Homeland Securities, Policing for Profit with John Adams. This program was recorded on Sunday, April 16th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within 10 days of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcast and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, where we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.